Before Tommy starts my time, I want to tell you, just like John did, or Buddy, if you didn't, if everybody here knows it, thank you so much for coming. The way we all approach this debate or discussion is it's not a contest to see who's the best debater or anything like that. Don't think of it that way. If you, say, were to go out and have a Bible study, and all of these men have probably heard me say this before, go out and have a Bible study with a non-Christian, say an hour or two, and you come home, your wife doesn't say, who won the Bible study? That doesn't make any sense. This is just an in-depth Bible study. Michael Couch is my friend. John is my friend. John's been my friend for 5 or 6 years. We do disagree doctrinally, and we both consider it to be very important. So we will press our points doctrinally, but it's nothing personal. It's just a Bible study, not a contest. Keep that in mind. We appreciate so much you coming. And you can just listen to what the presenters present and decide for yourself what the Bible teaches. That's everybody's responsibility, including mine. Mark put up chart number 2. If you will turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, 8 through 10, this will be one passage that I'm using as a basis to try to prove that the miraculous gifts of the Spirit have stopped. We agree with Michael that at the time, during the time of the New Testament church, they had miraculous gifts. Healing, tongues, prophecies, and so forth. I think there were 12 gifts listed in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. We believe, and we think the Bible teaches, and that's why we believe it, not because we want it that way, but because the Bible teaches that those gifts came to an end, and so they're not in operation today, and I'm going to show you that from the Bible. 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10 reads, "Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease." Get the idea? "Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away." All of us here, I think, after looking at this passage, would agree that prophecy and tongues would stop at some point when that which is perfect has come. The only question for debate is, what does that which is perfect refer to? Because we all agree that these things would stop at the time that which is perfect has come. I believe that which is perfect refers to the perfect or whole, complete, of God's revelation. That is, the completed New Testament. So if you're looking at my chart, my position explained but not proven is, when the means by which God provides the complete revelation, that is, the completed written New Testament, comes into existence. When that comes into existence, the means by which God provided the revelation in part, prophecy, tongues, and miraculous knowledge would go away. If I can prove that which is perfect refers to the completed New Testament, then I will have proven that prophecy and tongues stopped when the New Testament was completed. I will have proven my position. Now, let's look at a couple of definitions of words in this context. We have, in part, contrasted with perfect. And I asked Michael 5 questions before the discussion started. And I asked him a question something like, is there a contrast in this passage between the part and the perfect? And he agreed. So let's define these two words. First of all, perfect, in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 10. Now, this word doesn't so much refer to sinlessness or without fault, as we might use it today. But this Greek word translated perfect here is defined by Mr. Vine as reached its end, finished, complete, perfect. Thayer defines it as wanting nothing necessary to completeness. So when you think of perfect here, think of whole, mature, complete. Not necessarily faultless or sinless, but something that has gone from being incomplete to complete. Something that has gone from being in part, as we see the text to say, to something that has become complete or whole, okay? Now let's define the word part, and I'm defining the Greek word, not the English word. Thayer defines this as one of the constituent parts of the whole, universally in a context where the whole and its parts are distinguished or contrasted. Do you see that? I don't know if you can read my chart up there. It looks a little too light. But he gives an example, Luke 11:36, Thayer does. And then he says, in part, parts. And I want us to look at that example, Luke 11:36. So it has nothing really to do with our discussion. I think it helps us to see the idea I'm getting across about the part and the perfect being contrasted. Now remember, Thayer defines this word part, he says, one of the constituent parts of the whole, universally in a context where the whole and its parts are distinguished, in part or partially. And he gives Luke 11:36 as an example. In Luke 11:36 it says, "If thy whole body therefore be full of light, having no part dark, the whole shall be full of light. If thy whole body be full of light, having no part dark." No part of what? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? No part of the body. How did you know that? It didn't specify it there. It didn't say having no part of the body, dark. How did you know that? Because you know that the whole and the part here is being contrasted or distinguished. And you say, well, the part having no part, dark, part of what? And you go back and look at what the whole was. If thy whole body, therefore, be full of light, having no part, dark. You see, the whole is being contrasted with the part. The part is not named as part of what, but then you know that it's going to be of the same nature as the whole. And the whole is the whole body. That's how you knew that the writer here, Luke, was talking about part of our body. Because he said, if the whole body, therefore, be full of light, having no part, dark. No part of the body. They're of the same nature. It is exactly the same way in 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10. In 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10, he says, charity never fails, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect or whole is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. Now, he doesn't tell us in words what the perfect is. But just like he did with Luke 11, 36, the perfect is going to be of the same nature as the part, since they're contrasted in the passage. What is in part here? Is it a partial second coming of Christ? No. The thing that is in part is the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in part. Back before we had it all together, complete in one place, the complete New Testament revelation, He would reveal the New Testament law in part. How did you do that? With tongues, with prophecy, with miraculous knowledge. These are the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in part. So what would the whole be? What would the complete be? It would be, as I've argued, it would have to be. You would have to necessarily conclude it has to be the means by which God reveals His New Testament law in whole, in its full completeness. And we all agree that is the completed New Testament. I have it right here in my hand. And so the position that the Bible takes on this, that God takes on this, is that once you have all of the New Testament law all written and put together in one place so that we can just turn to it and find out what the truth is, then there would be no need for God revealing parts of the New Testament law by using the miraculous, like tongues and prophecy. That's the deal. I've heard it illustrated this way. Those of you in construction, you may put up some scaffolding. You put the scaffolding up. But when the building's completed, you don't need the scaffolding any longer. You see what I'm saying? It's the same way. Once the building was completed, once the New Testament law was completed, God didn't need the scaffolding anymore. He didn't have to keep revealing parts of it through prophecy and tongues. Now, it's not me saying that. That's the argument that Paul is making in this passage. I didn't write it. Paul did, through the inspiration of God. Notice the next chart, number 4, Mark. Notice the contrast here, if you can see the chart. On the left side, we have the in part or partial. On the right side, we have the perfect or complete. Notice the contrast here. For example, if you had a part or a piece of an apple pie or an apple, what would be the complete or the whole of that? A whole apple, right? If you had a part or a piece of an orange, what would be the whole of that? A whole orange. Now, what do we have in part in this text? It says we know in part and we prophesy in part. So what would be the complete of that? It wouldn't be the second coming of Christ. It would be a complete knowledge, complete prophecy. So on the left, we have partial revelation. What would the complete of that be? Complete revelation. Just like the complete of a piece of an apple is a complete apple, a whole apple, the complete of partial revelation would be complete revelation. Suppose the perfect, that which is perfect, referred to the second coming of Christ. You have a perfect or a complete second coming. What you would need on the left side, the thing in part, would be an in part, partial second coming. And that doesn't make any sense. And that's why I refuse to believe this is talking about the second coming of Christ. And so if you have a piece of an apple, the whole of that piece is not a whole orange. That's not right. And if you have partial revelation, the whole of that is not the complete second coming of Christ. I would submit to you that Michael is mixing apples and oranges. Number 6, Mark. Let me illustrate it some more in a rather humorous way, but I think it makes the point. I want you to see if you can tell which blank you should check here. I am going to quit my 2 part-time jobs when I get a glass of water or a full-time job. Which one? It's so obvious it's humorous. Of course, I'll quit my 2 part-time jobs when I get a full-time job. Because the complete is going to be the same nature as the part. Part-time job, I can quit those when I get the full-time job. It wouldn't have anything to do with a glass of water. Notice the next one. The power being out, we read by candlelight, so the electric shaver came back on, the electric lights came back on. That's obvious. When they moved to Dallas, they rented an apartment so they could buy a box of fried chicken or buy a house. Well, if it were me, I'd buy a box of fried chicken, but I think we all know the answer is supposed to be house. Instead of hamburgers, I would rather go get a box of fried chicken or a house. We see how the same nature thing works in our everyday language. Now, the last one, these are all very simple. The last one should be just as obvious. This is what's going on in 1 Corinthians 13. God's revelation in part, and that's what's going on, prophecy and tongues and miraculous knowledge, it actually says it's in part. God's revelation in part will be done away when the second coming in whole has come, or God's revelation in whole has come. Now those other ones were so easy, it was funny. That one's just as easy. God's revelation in part, prophecy and tongues will be done away when God's revelation in whole has come. Since God's revelation in whole, I can't tell you an exact year, but it was all written out, all 27 books in the New Testament, inspired, put together. Don't know what year it was, but let's say it was 125 A.D., just for the sake of argument. Then, what Paul is saying is the gift stopped by that time. Next, I would like you to keep looking at 1 Corinthians 13, but I want you to look at the last verse, 1 Corinthians 13. We've been looking at verses 8 through 10 extensively. Tommy, tell me how much time. Now let's look at verse 13. It says, "And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity." Now, what we have is a contrast going on here. Many of your newer translations, well, instead of saying "now" here, we'll have the word "but." In the Greek, this is the word "day." Vine defines this word as "but" and "now," often implying an antithesis. And then the word that you have "now" there, the second word of the King James Version, Vine defines that as "with logical import." And I love to get in Alabama stuff in here, so here's how... You know, we say, "I'm going to do something right now." That means now at this moment. But we also have a "now" that's the antithesis kind of now. Logical import, like this one. Auburn didn't win any national championships in the 1970s in football, but now Alabama did. You see, the word "now" is not now at this moment. Alabama hadn't won a national championship since 1992. Auburn didn't win any national championships in the 1970s, but now Alabama did. They won two or three. You see, it's "now" meaning logical import, antithesis. And that's what's going on here. There's a contrast. It says, "And now abideth faith, hope." That is set in contrast to prophecies, tongues, and miraculous knowledge stopping. It says, these three will abide. Not these six or these 12, but these three will abide. There's a contrast in between what's abiding in verse 13 and what's stopping in verses 8 through 10. You see, the prophecy, the tongues, and miraculous knowledge are stopping. But in contrast to that, faith, hope, and charity are going to abide. Now, let me continue on with some Bible teaching here. Okay? Faith and hope, we still have faith and hope today because they abided through that which is perfect. But faith and hope will stop at the second coming of Christ. You remember from 2 Peter 3, 9 and 10, the world will be burned up and destroyed at the second coming of Christ. There will be no more need for faith and hope after that. Now, let's look at some passages to prove that. First of all, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. It says, "Therefore, we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body, to be present with the Lord." Paul is saying that right now we walk by faith, not by sight. But once we get to heaven, it will be by sight. There will be no longer need to have faith. As Hebrews 11 verse 1 says, Hebrews 11 verse 1, please turn and look at your own Bibles. And I think Michael and John will agree with this particular point, that faith and hope, there will be no longer any need for it in heaven. Maybe I misunderstood, but we'll see what they say. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. See, faith is when you believe in something based on evidence even though you can't see or touch it. It's not blind faith. That's not what we teach. Faith is not a blind faith, not religious faith. Faith is you do have evidence, but you can't touch or feel God, but you know He's there by the evidence. The moon sitting up there in the sky tells us there's a God. No man could have created that. That's faith. You believe in God without touching Him or seeing Him because you have evidence. Okay? Once we see God, once we meet God face to face in heaven, it won't have to have faith in Him anymore. It'll be sight. That's the point made in 2 Corinthians 5 and Hebrews 11 verse 1. And notice the same thing is true about hope. We hope for heaven. Once we get to heaven, we don't have to hope for anymore. Turn to Romans chapter 8 verse 24. You'll see the same thing is taught about hope as we saw about faith. "For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? When I was young, I hoped for a bicycle. My parents gave it to me. I didn't have to hope for it anymore. I had it. I'm hoping for heaven now, but once I get it, I don't have to hope for it. I'll have it." So if you can see the chart, and mark them on number 7. If you can see the chart, we have a timeline there. A timeline, and I have on the left side the perfect. And then a little bit to the right, I have the second coming of Christ. Now, what 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 13 tells you is that faith and hope will not stop at that which is perfect. Yes, prophecy, tongues, and miraculous knowledge, they're going to stop at that which is perfect. But verse 13 is saying, those are going to stop, but now these are going to abide. Faith and hope will not stop at that which is perfect. Yet we've just proven that faith and hope stop at the second coming of Christ. So if faith and hope continue on past that which is perfect, but they stop at the second coming of Christ, that proves that that which is perfect cannot be at the same time as the second coming of Christ. It would have to be sometime previous to that. Now, it doesn't say when it is, but it tells you that it's not the same time. Now, we've already shown from verses 8 through 10 what that which is perfect is. This just confirms that by teaching us it cannot be the end of the world. It cannot be the second coming of Christ. Because faith and hope will continue on past that which is perfect, but they'll stop at the second coming of Christ. Number 8, Mark. Next, I would like you to turn to Zechariah chapter 13. Now, you need to turn there, because this is a passage you may not be overly familiar with, but it's a lot of prophecies in the Old Testament are maybe a little hard, but this one is pretty simple because we have so much in this context telling us that this prophecy is referring to the time period of the first coming of Christ. First of all, I want you to notice that the whole context, chapter 12 and 13, is talking about a single time period called that day. Chapter 12, verse 3, it says, "In that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people." That's Zechariah 12, verse 3. Verse 4, it says, "In that day, saith the Lord." Verse 6, "In that day will I make the governors of Judah," and so forth. Verse 8, "In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem." Verse 9, "It shall come to pass in that day." Verse 11, "In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem." Verse 11, oh, I just did that. Chapter 13, verse 1, "In that day." Chapter 13, verse 2, "It shall come to pass in that day." Chapter 13, verse 4, "It shall come to pass in that day." So this whole context is talking about a time period in that day. Now, it's not talking about one 24-hour day. Again, I'll go back to an analogy from Alabama football. In the day of Bear Bryant, Alabama won a lot of football games. I don't mean one 24-hour day. I mean in the time period when he was the coach. You follow what I'm saying? And that's what's going on here. Now, remember, this whole context refers to a time period entitled "In That Day." Now, notice Zechariah 13, verse 2. It says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And also I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirits pass out of the land." Now, God says that in that day, whenever that day is, whenever that time period is, that the prophets will pass out of the land. In other words, prophecy will cease. Now, I believe that we'll see that this context will show us that matches up with what we read in 1 Corinthians 13. Because we have established that the context here is talking about a time period in that day, and that the prophets will pass out of the land, that is, prophecy will stop. When does this refer to? When does Zechariah 13 refer to? I think it'll be easy for you to see. Notice chapter 13, verse 1. It says, "In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness." Do y'all sing the song, "There's a fountain free, 'tis for you and me"? What's it referring to? I believe it refers to this verse. The blood of Christ is called a fountain here. It's a fountain in the sense that, of course, it's a figure, but it's a fountain of blood. And the reason it's called a fountain, I believe, is because it's trying to get across the point that there's enough blood here to cover everybody's sins of all time. It's not just a little trickle, we might say. But I believe everybody here will agree when it says there's going to be a fountain open to the house of David for sin and uncleanness. That's talking about the death of Christ. Michael will agree with that, I'm pretty sure. He would have to. It's talking about the death of Christ. Now, is it talking about the time period of the second coming of Christ or first coming? First coming, right? Isn't that when Jesus died? He's not going to die again when he comes again, is he? First coming. Notice chapter 11, verses 12 and 13. It says, "And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said unto me, cast it into the potter, a goodly price that I was prized of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver, cast into the potter in the house of the Lord." What's that talking about? The New Testament shows us that's talking about Judas betraying Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. When he returned the money, they really didn't feel like they could take it back, so they used the money to buy a potter's field to bury people in. They didn't know who it belonged to. They bought a potter's field. Chapter 12, verse 10, it says, "I will pour out the house of David upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced." Whom they have pierced. John 19:37 reads, and again another scripture says, "They shall look on him whom they have pierced." That's talking about the death of Christ. When he was on the cross, they pierced him. That's what that's talking about. And then chapter 13, verse 7 says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man of that is thy fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones." The night before Jesus died, Jesus quoted that, Matthew 26, verse 31. He says, "For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered abroad." It quotes Zechariah 13, verse 7. The shepherd was Jesus, the sheep would be scattered. That was the apostles, the disciples being scattered at his death. Jesus quoted that the night before his death and said, "I'm going to fulfill this in just the present moment. When he died, the sheep were scattered." All of this context shows that the time period referred to by the phrase "in that day" refers to the time period of the first coming of Christ, not the second coming of Christ. And what did we see happen during the time period of the first coming of Christ? not one 24-hour day, but a time period, a number of years. The Bible says in verse 2 of Zechariah 13 that the prophets would pass out of the land. That matches up exactly with what we read in 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10, that during the time period of the first coming of Christ, which also we have the completed revelation done during that time period, the prophets, the true prophets, passed out of the land. I believe I've proven my top proposition.